We're coming to the end here on our study in Fundamentals off of Paul Little's book, Know What You Believe. We're coming to the end, and we've come to end times here, and that's what we're going to be talking about at least over the next 2 weeks. What's going to happen in the future? You know, it's fascinating, utterly fascinating to recognize that the Bible tells us what's going to happen in the future. I mean, we have a book that has predicted hundreds of times future events, and hundreds of those things have already come to pass. So it's got its credibility of foretelling future events with 100% accuracy. And so the excitement of realizing what's going to come to pass, and also to recognize with Jesus we're on the winning side, and everything's going to turn out okay, even though there's a hard road ahead. Prophecies that we find in the Bible, multifaceted, but I'd like to say they seem to center on God's Messiah. The coming of the Messiah, of course, both the first and second comings, as we read about it in the scriptures. Jesus came the first time as the suffering servant to deal with the issue of sin. He's coming again the second time as a conquering king, and the Bible has predicted both of those comings with a multitude of details surrounding them. In Isaiah 53, if you've turned over there, Isaiah 53, written 700 years before Jesus came, speaks so specifically on the work that he would accomplish in coming to lay his life down. And what it really focuses on is the substitute aspect of it, that he died in our place. And we see that. And I'm just going to kind of scan through it just as we bring that up. In Isaiah 53, verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. When you jump to verse 5, but he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. It's so clear that the suffering that he went through was not for himself. It wasn't anything that he brought upon himself, but it was for us. And he was bearing the judgment that really we should be bearing, because we're the ones who have sinned. And of course, the penalty of sin is God's judgment upon us. In verse 7, he was oppressed. He was afflicted. Reading on down in verse 7, he was led as a lamb to the slaughter. In verse 8, he was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. Verse 9, they made his grave with the wicked. You see the suffering, you see the substitutionary aspect of that suffering, and you see the fact that he died here in chapter 53. And of course, so pointedly predicting Jesus, who he is, what he would do. So the prophecies that foretell what's going to take place in his life, his suffering. In the same book, if we turn back to Isaiah chapter 9, in the same book, it not only speaks of his suffering, but it speaks of his glory and his majesty too. In Isaiah chapter 9, in verse 6, a very familiar passage to us, Isaiah 9:6, it says, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And we've got Christmas and Easter right there, don't we? A child is born in Bethlehem, a son is given at Calvary, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. And remember, this is speaking of Jesus. This is a prophecy of the Messiah. And he'll be called the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Now, as we look at this, we recognize, well, yeah, this is moving towards his second coming. The fact that he's going to reign. He's going to sit upon the throne of David, and he's going to reign, and of his kingdom there will be no end. He is king forever. Amen? Isaiah 53, on the other hand, he's suffering. He's dying a substitutionary death, and he does die. Now, you got to admit, if you lived in Isaiah's day, you would be reading these passages, and these aren't the only two passages, just a great example here coming from one prophet of these two different aspects of the coming of the Messiah. It would be challenging, would it not, to understand what he was talking about. Is he talking about the same person? He can't be talking about the same person. One of them's dying. One of them is going to be reigning forever. And yet from our vantage point, it's easy, isn't it? We can clearly see it. He came the first time, he died for our sin, and then he rose victorious from the grave. He's coming again, and he's going to reign forever. It's easy from our vantage point, and that's the point I'm trying to make here, from their vantage point, extremely difficult, and that's the nature of prophecy. When we look at prophecy, it's like we're looking through a dark glass. We can see it, but we can't necessarily make out all the details really clearly. It says the same thing about the prophets in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 and 11. It says, of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in them was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. These are the guys that wrote it down, and they didn't know what they were writing. You know, God's inspiring them to write these passages, and they're writing them, and they're probably looking back going, I don't get it. You know, I see in one case he's going to reign forever, and in another case he's dying. It just, how do we put the two of them together? But from our vantage point, again, it makes perfect sense because we can look back at fulfilled prophecy, and we recognize that he's alive and that he's coming again, and that he's going to reign forever. Keep that in mind as we look at end times. Because when we look into end times, I think all of us are going to have an opinion on what we think is going to take place. And we all generally, and really I'm going to give us a number of views here tonight on the different views of what's going to take place in the end times. There's one thing we all agree on. And that's Jesus is coming again, okay? And that's the clear picture that we can see. He's coming again. Exactly when he's coming, exactly the details around his coming, that's kind of what's debated, I guess you might say. So I try and be not overly dogmatic. I obviously have my opinion. And as I study the Bible and the years go by, I want to have an open mind. And I just encourage all of us to do the same as we look into the scriptures. In the Old Testament, the prophets predicted an event referred to as the day of the Lord, not referring to a 24-hour day, but referring to a time period, the day of Yahweh, a time where God would, in a very specific way, intervene, if you will, in human affairs to turn this world right side up, to deal with the issue of sin. I mean, I think most all of us really enjoy our lives for the most part. I mean, we live in a wonderful community with wonderful people. We got to remember, we're living in a fallen world too, though. There's death in this world. There's disease. There's injustice that takes place. You know, we kind of live with it. We get used to it. And we enjoy the good, but we got to remember, this isn't the world that God created. He created a paradise. And man's the one that messed it up. There's coming a day where God's going to turn everything right side up. And the day of the Lord, the prophets spoke of, a time where God would come, and he would come in judgment, and he would judge sin because our God is a just God. And as we read about the day of the Lord, it's an extremely hard, difficult time. But if you look at it as the blackest of night, if you will, before the dawning of a new day, or look at it as the birth pains, the labor pains before the coming of a brand new baby child, you know, that's coming in. That's the idea. It's going to get a whole lot worse before Jesus comes. A whole lot worse before it gets a whole lot better. Paul Little wrote in his book concerning the day of the Lord, the intervention of God in reclaiming the world and bringing the resolution of evil. For those who worship God, it will be a day of glorious hope. For those who serve evil and turn from God, final judgment will come. The day of the Lord is mentioned just here in the Old Testament, by Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Zephaniah, Zechariah, and Malachi. It's mentioned a lot, the day of the Lord. You're still in Isaiah? Look at Isaiah chapter 13. Here's one example of a number of passages that speak of the day of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 13, beginning from verse 6. It says, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be limp. Every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger." It's going to be an intense time, is it not? I mean, and this is one, I mentioned a number of prophets, one of many prophets that speak in the same vein. It's going to be a really, really difficult time that's going to come upon the earth. Now, the day of the Lord preceding the coming of Jesus Christ. And in talking about the coming of Jesus, this is where I want to give you the different views, because it really wouldn't be fair if I just gave you one view on end times. Because as I mentioned, prophecy, it's like we're looking, we can see the big picture, but all the details, it's really hard to be dogmatic about all of them. So I want to give you some of the different interpretations on what's going to take place in the end times, different approaches on that. And in doing so, also just make mention of why they're different. I mean, there's a reason why there's different interpretations of end time events. And we'll be talking about that as we take a look at it. The first thing we need to discuss, I think, is with the coming of Jesus, we need to look at what the Bible has to say concerning the 1,000 years that he's going to come and reign for. It's commonly referred to as the millennium, and that's taken from the Latin milli and annum for 1,000 years. The phrase 1,000 years is used 6 times in Revelation chapter 20, and that's right prior to, right after the second coming of Jesus. He comes in chapter 19, chapter 20, speaks of this 1,000-year time period. As an example, in Revelation chapter 20, verse 6, it says, "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So after his second coming in Revelation 20, it's talking about him reigning with others, take note, but him reigning for 1,000 years. And so that time period is commonly referred to as the millennium or the kingdom age, the time where Jesus is going to reign for 1,000 years. Now, this is where we get into different interpretations. Now, I might read through that and think, well, it says he's going to reign for 1,000 years, and so I believe he's going to come back, and for literally 1,000 years, he's going to be sitting on the throne of David, and he's going to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Somebody else might look at that and go, well, it's speaking in kind of an allegorical way. It's not like it's a real 1,000 years, and it's not necessarily that he's even going to come back to earth, necessarily. And so you can see that there could be different interpretations and why there's different interpretations. Because there's a literal approach, and then there's a figurative approach. And really, there's nothing necessarily wrong with interpreting something figuratively, because there are passages in the Bible where we're supposed to see things as an allegory. We just want to make sure that we're recognizing that the Bible's telling us to interpret it as allegory when we're reading through it. And it does do that. I think personally, and you're obviously are going to get my opinion on what I think the right interpretation is, I think our approach should be a literal approach. And one of the main reasons I think that is because we have a precedent. The prophecies concerning Jesus' first coming were fulfilled literally. He literally was born in Bethlehem. It wasn't a figurative, you know, just some nice place upon the earth, but literally he was born there. And so I think the prophecies concerning his second coming and the details that surround it, that would be my approach to approach it literally. But a lot of the church, and I'm speaking of the, what did we talk about it last week, the universal church, the global church, and talking about people, you know, who are saved just like you and I are, that trust Jesus, don't necessarily interpret it that way. The first one I want to just touch on is amillennialism. Amillennialism, when you speak about the millennium and then you take that letter A, we see that in the Greek, it takes the word and it negates it. So amillennialism would be no millennium. So a person who's an amillennialist does not believe there is a literal thousand-year reign of Christ. So they would look at it more symbolically, as I've already been stating. It was promoted by Augustine. It was something that was believed before him, but it was promoted by Augustine in the 4th century and has been the favored eschatological position. That means end times position. It just sounds very scholarly to say that, you know. The favored eschatological position in the Catholic Church for the past 1,600 years. Amillennialists interpret the millennium, that thousand years, as the church age from Pentecost to the second coming. The thousand years, therefore, is symbolic of a much longer period. They also believe that Christ bound Satan during his earthly ministry. Now, why would they put that in this little paragraph here? Well, because in Revelation chapter 20, it tells us that Satan is bound for a thousand years. And so, again, if you approach it literally, you would look at it that he has no power during this thousand-year reign. But if you look at it in a figurative way, they would say, well, that's referring to when Jesus came and he died on the cross. Remember, it says that he broke the power of the devil, which he did. You know, he died for the sin of the world and so that we can be set free. So that's where they're coming from with this. That the first resurrection is the new birth, being born again, and that Christ will physically return in glory to judge, but that this coming will begin eternity, not the millennium. And so when the Bible speaks of the new heaven and the new earth, the allegorical approach here would be, we're looking for him to come. And that's the common denominator, which is cool. Everybody's looking for Jesus to return. But in the millennialist position, when he comes, that's where eternity begins. Does that make sense? Okay. Currently, the kingdom is the spiritual presence of the risen Christ in the physical church. Amillennialists believe that unfulfilled Old Testament prophecies are being fulfilled spiritually through the church. Unfulfilled Old Testament prophecies that concern the nation of Israel are being fulfilled in the church. And so it's a spiritualizing of many passages in the scriptures to come with a interpretation that there is no millennium. So that makes a person an amillennialist. Another view is postmillennialism. And it's similar to amillennialism in a sense. Most postmillennialists believe that the millennium is not a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ, but a period of time that begins during the church age and extends to the second coming. The millennium, according to postmillennialists, is that latter part of the church age characterized by revival, the successful permeation of the gospel through the earth. So the idea here is not that Jesus is going to return and set up his kingdom, rather that kingdom age of Christ reigning is actually him reigning through the church. And the church is taking the gospel and having such an effect on their world that it Christianizes the world, and Jesus comes at the end of that period. So post, at the end, post-millennialist. So again, not a literal 1,000 years, but a time of Christ reigning through the church and transforming our world. If I read on, you would see that this position started losing its power after World War I and World War II as humanity was watching itself self-destruct as we started getting not better, but we started getting worse. It has come around and is kind of a new vamp on post-millennialism in recent years. But that's the idea. And you can see that this fuels part of what you'll see as Kingdom Now theology. It's pretty subtle, but it's around us and in our midst. And don't get me wrong, there is an element of we as the church need to impact our culture. We need to make a difference. We need to let our light shine. But there are those that hold to this view that are seeing this type of interpretation and going, we are going to impact our culture and we are going to Christianize this world, and then Jesus is going to return. So it's kind of two different aspects and something to keep in mind as we see different movements that are in our midst, some of them that we would agree with, you know. And again, I'm not knocking making an impact on our culture. We need to do that. We want to do that. But Jesus is going to come. He's going to return whether we turn this world right side up or not. And I would agree with many who would say that it seems to be getting a whole lot worse than a whole lot better. We need Jesus now more than ever. So that brings me to premillennialism. And if you haven't been able to tell yet, this is the one that I would lean towards. And it would be the literal approach to this. Premillennialists believe that Christ will return at the end of the church age and establish a physical kingdom on earth for a literal 1,000 years. The thing that I'll throw out to that is, again, the phrase 1,000 years is used 6 times in Revelation chapter 20. And so it's almost like it's repeated over and over again. And it just seems to make the most sense to take it literally. Most premillennialists believe that the return of Christ is preceded by the 70th week of Daniel. And that's something we'll be talking about. The 70th week of Daniel is a week of years, a 7-year period that is yet to be fulfilled, a prophecy that was given in Daniel chapter 9. And by the way, that's the book that we're going to be starting after we finish this series. In Daniel chapter 9, it predicts a 70-week prophecy, and there's one final week, one final 7-year period that hasn't been fulfilled yet. And so premillennialists, again, believe that the return of Christ is preceded by the 7-year period, which includes a time of great tribulation upon the earth. Premillennialists disagree as to whether the church will be raptured, meaning taken off the earth, before, in the middle of, or after the tribulation. Dispensational premillennialists do not hold that Old Testament promises to Israel apply to the church, but rather that the nation of Israel will one day be restored and converted to faith in Christ during the tribulation. And so again, a dispensational, because there were two viewpoints, and that's why that point is being made there, in a premillennialist believes that those promises that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the extent of their land, the borders of their land, the promises that were given to them, are promises that are going to be fulfilled. So a premillennialist would look at Israel coming back to her land in 1948 as a fulfillment of prophecy. But an amillennialist would not see that as a fulfillment of prophecy at all, because they don't take that passage to be a literal 1,000-year reign where Jesus is going to return. They don't see the promises that were made to Israel as being fulfilled to Israel, but rather being fulfilled to the church. That can lead itself to what's called a replacement theology, where the church has now replaced Israel, and all of the things that God said about Israel are now we're going to be the ones that reap them. You have to remember, they weren't all good, you know? They weren't all blessings that were promised to Israel. There was also some challenging things that that were declared toward the nation of Israel. And so we can't just take, if we're going to take that, we can't just take the good and not take the bad. So again, different doctrines that are based on it. You know what I see, you guys, as a common thread through this? Why are there different interpretations? It's the approach to the Bible. Is it an allegorical approach? In other words, we read it and we take it figuratively and, oh, it applies to this, or is it a literal approach? And again, I believe that the Bible was written in a way where we should take it from a literal standpoint. They call it the historical grammatical approach. And again, that sounds fancy and everything. All it means is we recognize it's a book that was written in history, and it's a book that was written with words, historical, grammatical. If I wrote you a letter, you would pick it up and you would think that I meant what I said in the letter that I wrote. You wouldn't hopefully be trying to read between the lines, what did he mean by that? You know, and spiritualize the passage. And yet we tend to do that with the Bible, meaning Christians tend to do that with the Bible, and it's not the best way to interpret it. I take us back to the precedent. The prophecies concerning Jesus' first coming, they were fulfilled literally, and that lays a good foundation for us in interpreting prophecy that has not yet come to pass. So with the premillennial viewpoint, in other words, looking at it that Jesus is going to return, we also, as I just mentioned, have differing interpretations as to the church. Is the church going to go through that last 70th week of Daniel, that seven-year period, the day of the Lord, that time of unprecedented judgment upon the earth? Are they going to be taken out? Are they going to be raptured out prior to it? Is it going to take place? Is it going to take place prior to it, or in the mid point of that happening, or at the very end of it? Are they going to be removed from it? The rapture of the church, there's two key passages in the Bible. One of them is 1 Thessalonians 4. I just want to look at one verse of that right now. It says in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, "Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord." If you search through your Bible for the word rapture, you're not going to find it. When you think of the pre-tribulation rapture theory or the mid-trib rapture, you're not going to find the word rapture in the Bible, but you will find these two words, caught up. That is a translation of the Greek word harpazo. If you had a Latin version of the Bible, you would see the word, because those two words caught up in the Latin would be raptus, from which we get our word rapture. And it simply means to be snatched away. And so in this passage, it's saying that we who are alive and remain, and that's when the Lord comes, shall be snatched away, shall be caught up together with them. And it's talking about the dead in Christ that are raised. And we'll get to the verse before this in just a minute. But we'll be caught up, snatched away to meet the Lord in the clouds, and thus always be with the Lord. And this is the doctrine, the teaching of the rapture of the church, or the snatching away of the church. Now, it's interesting to see that that pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib, I mean, they all believe in the snatching away of the church. It's just a timing aspect. When is the church going to be snatched away? Is it going to be before this seven-year period of tribulation and judgment upon the earth? Or is the church going to go halfway through that and then be taken out? Or is the church going to go all the way through that and the Lord is going to remove them out at that point? And that brings us to these again, differing interpretations. We've already talked about the millennial viewpoints based on, is Jesus literally coming back to reign? Now we're going to talk about the tribulational viewpoints on when, if you are a premillennialist, believing he's going to come back, when is he going to take his church out? Everybody with me on that? So the first one we want to go to is the pre-tribulational view. In the pre-tribulational view, the pre-tribulationist holds to the future fulfillment of the 70th week of Daniel and some of the details around that. The Antichrist makes a covenant with the nation of Israel, which is followed by the seven-year tribulation period. Prior to this entire seven-year period, the church will be resurrected, raptured with living saints, and taken to the Father's house. And there will be a time, and we'll look into this, of the judgment seat of Christ for works that were done in the body, 2 Corinthians 5:10. following their conversion to Christ. After the 7 years, Christ will return in glory, destroy the Antichrist and the false prophet, bind Satan, cast him into the bottomless pit, Revelation 20. Christ will then set up a physical kingdom of his saints who will rule with him over the world. This view is characterized by belief in the literal thousand-year millennium, a physical distinction between Israel and the church, a differentiation between the rapture and the second coming, and the imminence of Christ's return. A lot of details in there. But the basic idea here is the belief that Jesus is coming and moving his church off the earth before this time of judgment hits. Kind of like, remember when we were doing Hebrews 11, and Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, because God took him. And he had this testimony that he was pleasing to God. God saw Enoch, and it's as if he reached down and took him to heaven with him. Elijah, taken up into heaven with the chariot of fire. We've got a whole generation of believers that are taken off the earth before this time of judgment comes. Come on, that's the pre-trib, before this time of judgment. The mid-trib view is similar to the pre-tribulational view, except that mid-tribulationalists believe that the rapture of the church takes place in the middle of the tribulation. Proponents of this view state that the first half of the tribulation is characterized by the persecuting local wrath of the Antichrist on the church, while the second half begins the universal and inescapable wrath of God. The prophecy of the two witnesses, Revelation 11, is used by mid-tribulationalists as evidence for the church's rapture prior to God's wrath. I don't know if you caught that, but the key thing here in the mid-trib view is that, and I find this as well with reading post-trib, which we'll see in a moment, is that they realize that the church is not destined for the wrath of God. That God is not going to give the church over to wrath. So from the mid-trib standpoint, the first half of these 7 years, it's not God's wrath, it's Satan's persecution. I mean, remember Jesus said, in this world, you will have tribulation. And we do have difficult things in this world. And so that's the concept with the mid-trib. The first half of that 7 years, it's chaotic, but it's not God's wrath. And so midpoint through the tribulation, God removes his church. And then those last 3.5 years is God's wrath that's being poured out. It's a similar view to the pre-wrath rapture theory, which takes place a little bit farther than the midpoint of the tribulation. The post-trib theory. According to the post-tribulational view, the church will endure the entire 70th week of Daniel, including either a 3.5 or 7 year tribulation. Post-tribulationalists identify the rapture with the second coming. So they're one and the same. And we'll talk about the distinction between the two in a moment. But for the post-trib, it's one and the same. When Jesus comes, he's coming for his church, and he's coming to set up his kingdom. Now, with this, when you think about it, in the other views, okay, when Jesus comes and removes his church off the earth, then there's a time of judgment. And during that time of judgment, people do become believers at that time. And then Jesus returns at his second coming. Who's going to populate the millennium during that time? I mean, you've got Jesus returning with believers in glorified bodies. Who are the people that he and the church are going to reign over during that time? Well, it would be the people who became believers during the tribulation. In the post-trib theory, though, who are they going to reign over? If this, you're right at the end and the church is taken out, who are they going to reign over? Well, the answer to that is unbelievers will be reigned over. They'll be ruled with a rod of iron during the millennium. Also, again, according to this interpretation, not just unbelievers, but Israel at the end will turn to the Lord and be reigning over them. And those who would be born during the millennial time period. And so I'll be honest with you, none of these views and interpretations are not without difficulty. Remember again, you guys, we're looking through a dark glass at future things, and we're trying to make out fine details, and it becomes kind of challenging to do that. So according to the post-tribulationalists, the millennium is a mix of resurrected saints, the church that are ruling and reigning with Christ, believing Jews, national Israel, and also unbelievers. So in looking at all this, we have the amillennialists, postmillennialists, premillennialists, and then within that we have the pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib. We also have pre-wrath, and we also have a partial rapture theory. The partial rapture theory is when Jesus comes, he's not taking everybody. He's only taking those saints who are really living for Jesus. You know what I mean? We're not talking about the ones that ditch church to watch a football game. We're talking about the ones that are really living for Jesus. That's the partial rapture theory. You know what that does is that, and I'm serious, you know what that does? It makes the rapture a work, really, that I was good enough to go in the rapture. And none of us are good enough to go. It's grace. It's not works. And I believe that's very clear with that. So with all of this, the key denominator through it all is he is coming again. And that's what I think we need to focus on. Stance of our church. It's the stance of Calvary Chapel is the pre-trib, premillennial, I guess I should say that the other way, the premillennial, pre-tribulational interpretation of these. This is out of Tim LaHaye's Prophecy Study Bible. He wrote the Left Behind series, and it's a neat study Bible, and it has some neat pictures in it too, so I thought I'd put this one up here. And it gives you a timeline from that viewpoint. Now, in all fairness, I've gone over the other viewpoints, because I think we all should be aware of what those viewpoints are, and you guys are all going to make your own decision, have your own opinion, just like I have my own opinion, okay? We don't want it to divide us, all right? That's the thing we don't want. We don't want this to be a dividing fact. Well, I can't fellowship with him because he's not, you know, we don't want to do that, okay? We're going to find out, okay? And really, when you think about it, this only affects the last generation. Think about everybody who's lived from the time of the apostles until now. I mean, they've died. If the Lord comes after our lifetime, we're going to die too. So it doesn't affect us. You know, I do think it's important. I don't think it's something we should just blow out. Oh, it doesn't matter. I met a guy, you know, his teacher. I don't know what book I was in, but it was something where we were doing end time events. At the end of the service, he goes, you know, you talk about all of these, you know, pre-trib, mid-trib. I'm a pan-trib. And I'm like, really? What's that? He goes, well, I believe it's all going to pan out in the end anyway, you know? And, you know, there's an element of truth in that. You know, I know there's an element of truth, but I do think it's important for us to do diligence in studying and have an opinion concerning prophecy. Because when we look at the landscape, the prophetic landscape, it's exciting. I mean, we see things taking place in our day. Israel being regathered is a huge thing. And I mean, that's huge. And other things that have followed on the heels of that, that just build an anticipation within us that we recognize we're getting close. Yeah, we're getting really close. And again, the imminence of it, that we could be taken out at any moment, it creates an anticipation inside of us. It's a powerful witnessing tool. I mean, think about it, the Left Behind series, a powerful impact on the church and on a lot of different people. And I think that's, again, the nature of prophecy concerning the end times. And so it is something that, yes, it's true. In one sense, it's all going to pan out in the end. In another sense, it's good for us to be focused and study and I think definitely have an opinion on it. So with this timeline here, as we just take a look at it, from the past, we move forward. We're in the church age right now where the gospel is going out to both Jew and Gentile alike, and people are getting saved through faith in Jesus Christ. From the pre-tribulational view, the next event on the horizon would be the rapture of the church, where Jesus removes the church from the earth prior to this seven-year period of tribulation. And Jesus is the one that used the phrase in Matthew 24, there will be great tribulation such as the world has not seen or will ever see again. So it's unprecedented time of chaos, of judgment upon the earth. Again, that is what the prophets were speaking about when they spoke of the day of the Lord, where we started in Isaiah 13, that time of not just dealing with sin on the earth, but the cataclysmic things that are taking place in the heavens as well. While that's happening on the earth, this gives a space for what the Bible speaks of as the Bema seat, or the judgment seat of Christ, and also the marriage of the Lamb. So while the church is in heaven, there is this evaluation of believers, the Bema, of what we've done while we've been on the earth as Christians. And so it's, you know, some liken it to a rewards banquet where, you know, you've ran your race like we were talking about on Sunday, and the athletes, the Olympic athletes, come up and they're on the platform and they're receiving those crowns, so to speak, those rewards and so forth. Some have likened it to that. It's not a judgment concerning sin, because sin was dealt with at the cross, and as a believer, your sin has been covered by the blood. But it does speak about what we've done in the body while Christians, whether good or bad. And so that is, I'll tell you, it's a sobering motivator, 2 Corinthians 5:10, to read that. It's accountability, that we're going to be accountable for what we've done, not accountable for our sin to where, oh, sorry, you're not going to make it into heaven. That was dealt with at the cross. But Paul talks about the buildings that we build using this figure of speech. We can build with gold, silver, and precious stones, or we can build with wood, hay, and straw, and it's going to be tested by fire. So the wood, hay, and straw are not going to remain. So in a sense, it could be all of these things that I did, but I'm not going to be rewarded for. 1 Corinthians 3, 1 Corinthians 4 points out it's the motive of the heart. It's not necessarily the things I did, it's why I did the things I did. Wow. Again, a sobering motivator, not just to do, but a sobering motivator to, God, help my heart be in the right spot. I can't tell you how many times that's my prayer, you know. I know my heart's not in the right spot right now, and I know the main thing that I need is just a shake-up, and Lord, I want to have a good outlook, a good attitude through all of this. Every time I talk about the Bema seat, it's sobering. It's sobering for me, and I see it, you know, I see it on y'all's faces too, because, you know, it's a reality that, you know, we're going to stand before him, but recognize again, it's the work that we allow him to do through us. It's us yielding our lives to him as Christians. And then, you know, talk about a win-win situation. We yield to him to allow him to work, and then he rewards us for us allowing him to work through our lives. You know what I mean? He's just good. So I don't know exactly what that's going to be like, but this would be the time window that that would take place. The church has been taken up, and we're before the Lord during that time. And then comes the marriage of the Lamb. The church is likened to a bride and Jesus as the groom. And it's the two becoming one. And we talked about that a little bit as we spoke about the church and the different aspects of the church. So that happening as the tribulation is taking place on the earth, the tribulation, it all ends, it all culminates in the battle or the campaign of Armageddon. Armageddon, this last great conflict that will take place in north central Israel in the Valley of Megiddo. Many wars have been fought there, and this is where the armies of the world will be gathered together, and they will be fighting, and they will turn their sights on Jesus as he's coming at his second coming, Revelation 19. He's coming on a white horse. He's coming with the armies of heaven, I believe made up of the angelic host and made up of the church that's been taken out and now in those glorified bodies, returning with him. And he is going to put an end completely to man's ungodly rule upon the earth. That will be the end of it right there. Matthew 25 speaks of what scholars call the judgment of the nations, where he will separate the sheep from the goats. And you'll have the believers that became believers during the tribulation coming in to the kingdom age, and the unbelievers at that time going into outer darkness. And so my understanding is the kingdom age starts with believers. It starts with people who have recognized Jesus as their savior, humans, and also those who have gone before, whether died and gone to heaven or raptured at the church, now in immortal bodies that will be ruling and reigning with him during that time period on the earth. So there's the second coming. There's the 1,000-year reign of Christ. At the end of this, the earth, the heavens completely dissolved. Everything that's here is just boom, gone, and a great white throne. And this is the time where the unbelieving dead will be resurrected and stand before Jesus. And it says the books will be opened, the books that contain the works that they did. It says they will be judged according to the things written in the books, and there'll be the book of life. And if the person's name is not found written in the book of life, they'll be cast into the lake of fire. This is the final judgment at the end of the 1,000 years. And you know, the way you get your name in the book of life is by putting your faith in Jesus Christ. That's it. He came to die in our place. That's where we started in Isaiah 53. It's that substitutionary death. And when we say, I want you, Jesus, as my Lord and Savior, then he forgives you of your sin and your name is written in the book of life. And so you are the one that gets to spend eternity with him, and that's right where it goes. It goes into what we would consider as heaven when we think of heaven and being with him forever and ever, Revelation 21 and 22. And so therein is the timeline for that. What I wanted to talk about in the last few minutes we have left is just look at the key scriptures for the rapture of the church. And that's 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and also 1 Corinthians chapter 15. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning from verse 16, it says, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." So those believers who have died. "Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up," there's our word harpazo, rapture from the Latin, "shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." Notice it's a meeting up in the air. It's not Jesus on the earth. It's me going up to meet him in the air. "And thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words." I want you to notice that these words were written to comfort, not to divide the church. You know what I mean? I'm a pre-trib. Well, I'm a mid-trib. They were written to comfort that there's coming a day where we're going to be with our loved ones who are believers that have already died. And we're going to be, and this is the 1 Corinthians 15 passage, we're going to be changed. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about the resurrection. And he says, "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep." And in the New Testament, oftentimes that's the word that's used for a believer who has died, that they have slept. Okay? So we shall not all sleep. In other words, as believers, we shall not all die. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. That's talking about the needed change to be able to inhabit eternity, if you will. We're in bodies that are dying. We're in bodies that are corrupted by sin. So that's why it says this corruption has to be clothed in incorruption. In other words, however the sin has marred our very nature, that's what has to be changed and done away with. We live in bodies that are decaying as well. And so this mortal is to be clothed with immortality. There's a change and this is how I see it with these two scriptures. And not just me, but when the Lord comes, you've got the dead bodies that are in the ground. And I won't go into a lot of detail on all of this just for time's sake. But they're going to be brought to life, the believers in Jesus. They're going to be changed. We who are alive are going to be changed, and we're going to be caught up together in these incorruptible, immortal bodies to meet the Lord in the air. In the air. And thus always be with the Lord. Those are the two key rapture texts. Another one that goes with that is John 14. This is the night that Jesus was betrayed. John 14, Jesus said, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions," literally abodes, dwelling places. "If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you," notice, "I will come again. I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." The rapture of the church. The second coming of Christ. From a pre-trib viewpoint, those two events are separated by 7 years. The church is taken out, 7 years of tribulation, and Jesus comes at his second coming. Here's some of the distinctions between the rapture and the second coming. Apologize for the small font, but I really didn't want to retype that, so I just took the picture and put it up there, okay? So with the rapture, Christ comes for his own. With the second coming, Christ comes with his own. Revelation 19, he's coming with the armies of heaven. In the rapture, he came in the air. That's why I was making such a point of that. We're going to meet him in the air. The second coming, he comes to the earth. He's coming specifically to the Mount of Olives. And that's the place that he ascended into heaven from. The rapture, only his own see him. We're caught up and we meet him in the air. The second coming, every eye will see him. The rapture, the saved are delivered from wrath. That would be pre-trib and also, you know, with speaking of the wrath of God mid-trib and others as well. In those viewpoints is what I meant. Saved are delivered from wrath. In the second coming, the unsaved experience God's wrath because when Jesus comes, he's coming as a conquering king to conquer man and his ungodly rule on the earth. The rapture, no signs precede the rapture. And that's why you'll hear of the imminent return of Jesus. In other words, he could come. Nothing has to take place before the rapture happens. The second coming, on the other hand, signs precede that. I think the most notable one would be the abomination of desolation that's set up in the holy place. Okay, so clear things that take place prior to his second coming. So there's just a little bit of a comparison with the two. I think when we speak about the pre-trib rapture, there's definitely in that viewpoint a distinction between the church and Israel. Not to say it's not that way with everyone on the other points, but by and large, the pre-trib point is taking that literal and thus distinct view between Israel and the church. God's elect are seen in the tribulation. Who are God's elect? The nation of Israel, okay? And they're in the book of Revelation, it's kind of interesting because Revelation is the most detailed account in the Bible on this period known as the Day of the Lord or the 70th week of Daniel. It's interesting to note that the church, the word church, is used a number of times in the first three chapters, and you never hear of it again until you get to the end of the book after the second coming. It's kind of interesting to see that, huh? So you're talking about the church in Smyrna, the church in Philadelphia, and so forth. And then during this big window of the tribulation, you'll read of the elect, but you don't read of the church until you come to the end, the second coming, and of course, the new heaven and the new earth. The nature of the tribulation, I think, is what stands out, not only to pre-trib, but others as well, because from a pre-wrath standpoint, I mean, that's still a not going through the wrath of God. And that's where we pull in the nature of the tribulation. As again, one of our opening verse scriptures, Isaiah 13, God is pouring out his wrath and he's judging sinners. So for the church to be on the earth during that time of judgment doesn't go well with the nature of the tribulation because it is a time of God's wrath, his judgment upon the earth. In Revelation 6:17, it says, "For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come." 1 Thessalonians 5:9 says, "God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ." And 1 Thessalonians 5, the context there is clearly in the tribulation, speaking of the tribulation. So again, you all will make your own opinion, have your own opinion. And as we have open minds and as we study and as the years go by and we keep open minds, we learn a little bit more, you know, get the timeline acquainted with different things, the different viewpoints. As we read through our Bibles, we're going to be like, you know what, this is what makes the most sense to me. And that's what we want to do. We simply want to be good students of the Word. And, you know, as we're looking through this glass, we recognize that the key thing that we all agree upon is Jesus is coming again. And that's our blessed hope. That's what we look forward to. This is another timeline that I was going to use pretty much the same information, but I liked the other picture better, but I still like this one, so I wanted to show it to you. You go back to the cross where Jesus died for our sin, and then you have 70 AD, the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. Really kind of significant because the old system has passed away. We're now under the new covenant. And then again, the church age, the rapture, the bema, that's the Greek word, the judgment seat of Christ, the marriage of the Lamb. On earth, it's the tribulation. And this is another thing. There's a real clear detailed in the tribulation pointed out, whether it's Revelation or Daniel, it's 3.5 years, it's 42 months, it's 1,260 days. It's a time, times, and half a time. I mean, to just, in my opinion, to just take that as, well, it just means kind of this, you know, arbitrary period of time when it's been detailed so well, I think that's the way we're meant to take it, is very specific as we see that. And so the end of that, the Battle of Armageddon, the Second Coming, the thousand-year reign of Christ on the earth, then the destruction of the heavens and the earth, the great white throne judgment, and then on into eternity. So what we have coming up are basically these topics that we're going to cover. I think we'll dive into much more of them next week as we just touch on them. I mean, there's hundreds of scriptures that this is formulated from. So it's just an overview that we're getting, okay? Well, if you have any questions, why don't we go ahead and pray, and then we can get comments and questions then. Father, thank you for the time that we could spend here in your word. And thank you also for the excitement, the anticipation, but also the sobering impact that end times has on our lives as individuals and also our concern for others. And I pray that you would have your perfect way in our lives, that we would take heed to what your word has to say, and that we would use our lives, yield them over to you, to allow you to do exactly what you want to do, to touch the world that we live in while we have this time. In Jesus' name, amen.